Are fish ever cannibals? What is fish stalking? And how does one become a Dr. Fish? Let's get to it and ask Dr. Fish. Okay, welcome to Ask Dr. Fish, everybody. As you can see, we do not have Stuart Carlton today, so you have Carolyn making horn music instead. Let's introduce our hosts. First, Dr. Katie O'Reilly, who is a Dr. Fish and is the Aquatic Invasive Species Specialist for Illinois Indiana Sea Grant. Katie, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great, even better being serenaded by a lovely horn solo. So thank you, Carolyn.
You're very, very welcome. Our second Ask Dr. Fish is Dr. Titus Seilhammer, who is a fishery specialist with Wisconsin Sea Grant. Titus, how are you today?
Good morning. It is a wonderful, this is, my favorite day of the every other month. So great to be here talking to you two. Hey, Stuart, he's great, but we're going to have fun without him too.
And of course, I am not a Dr. Fish. I am not a doctor anything. I am the research coordinator with Illinois Indiana Sea Grant. My name is Carolyn Foley, and I will be popping in and out, also trying to help run things behind the scenes today. So as a reminder, if you have not joined us before, this is Ask Dr. Fish, where we can take your fish questions, science questions, or life questions live. The easiest way to ask questions of the doctors during the show today, in particular, is going to be to type them into the chat if you're watching us on Facebook or YouTube. But otherwise, we're going to start having a conversation about some topics anyway, because there are cool things that come up. So, Katie, I believe you said nothing better to talk about on a Monday morning. Let's talk about cannibalism in fish.
Exactly. I mean, there is no better way to kick off, a busy work week than talking about cannibalism. So this was inspired. There was a news article that came out about some fossils that had been, I think, re-examined. And what they found is this ancient fish species had some younger members of the same species in its digestive system. And this is kind of cool because it shows that this ancient species was doing cannibalism of younger members of its own species. But that's something that's actually pretty common even in the fish we still have, swimming in the Great Lakes today. I think Titus, you talked a little bit about northern pike being cannibalistic, but really I feel like a lot of predatory fish species really abide by the seafood diet, meaning if they see food, they're going to eat it.
Yeah, that's absolutely true, Katie. They are out there, they are eating, and really imagine that you're, if you are a fish that eats other fish, and in general, from what we know about, the life strategy, kind of reproductive strategy for a lot of these fish, they're kind of usually not investing a lot of resources. Like you're putting out a lot of eggs, a lot of reproductive material, and just kind of, leaving it out there. So even if you are, say, you're eating another fish of your own species, and it's a little fish, it's probably not your kids. So if you're eating someone else's kids, you're actually helping, you're helping your offspring. So our little video here just showing, fish eating other fish, and that's a really big muskie eating a slightly smaller northern pike.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
I mean, I like that he's just kind of swimming around with it, like, okay. It
It's
almost
like this
feels,
is,
yeah.
yeah, this is mine. I'm gonna
This is
try
mine.
eat this. I don't know what the logistics are on getting that,
But it's mine.
swallowing that, but I have seen pictures of like, a giant lake trout with a slightly, just slightly smaller fish that
Slightly
they've
different.
been able to swallow, and the tail's sticking, still sticking out of the mouth. So fish like to eat other fish.
They do. And I'm glad you brought up, Titus, the idea that a lot of times it's fish eating younger, not their children. But even in some cases, parents will eat their offspring, which I'm sure, any stressed parent has probably thought about once or twice. But the example I really like is a species that lives in the Great Lakes called the fantail darter. So darters are typically these, small little guys that hang out at the bottoms of streams. doesn't seem too frightening or anything, but the males actually will eat their own eggs. But what's weird about it is they eat the eggs if there's only a few of them. So like if they have a big egg mass that they're protecting, they typically won't eat as many of those eggs. But if it's only a few eggs, it's basically this kind of trade-off for them. They don't want to expend that much energy for what would be kind of like a not great return on investment. So it's interesting that they'll eat all of the eggs because they're like, this is outweighing the benefit or outweighing the energy I would spend protecting them. So yeah, so this came from a study. It's a couple decades old now, 1997. But you know, I think what's
Katie,
cool
there, making me feel old here. I was in college in 97, but could have contributed to something like this.
Exactly. You know,
what's the cutoff on eggs? Like what's their over under? Yeah. Like what's too few to make it worthwhile?
That's a really good question. I think, you know, from what I read in the study, all of the male fantail darters will eat some eggs, but it really, you know, really comes down to, is this going to be worth my time? And so, you know, maybe it's a clutch of less than 100. Because, you know, sometimes a lot of fish will lay a lot of eggs, as you talked about, with the assumption that not many of them will survive.
Yeah. I mean, I have the same problem with things like, we just had a lot of Valentine's Day candy. Now it's all on sale. And it's like, I'm going to eat all of it. And so same strategy here.
Same strategy. Exactly.
That's hilarious. So I'm certainly not thinking about how I wouldn't eat my children. It's never gonna happen. We do have a question though from Stuart Carlton.
Our usual host, occasional guest question answerer when he's not available.
Yeah. So don't some male catfish carry young in their mouth? If so, do they ever eat them? And maybe I'll throw that to Katie first to see if you have some thoughts there.
Yeah. So there are a ton of species of fish where either the males or the females will basically carry the young in their mouth as a sort of protection mechanism to protect them from other predators that might eat them. I'm not entirely sure like how often consumption happens in that case. You know, it's very possible. And there, like I said, there's a whole range of species that do it. So I don't know to what extent it is. Maybe it's an accidental swallowing. It's like, uh-oh, you know.
Yeah, I mean, you got all these kids swimming around in your mouth. And they could, you know, if they swim the wrong way, they're really persistent about it. You know, evolutionarily, that's probably not a behavior that you really want to support in your mouth brooding young. So,
right.
Yeah, probably, you know, take care of that.
And one other thing, I mean, this is, you know, not specific to the ones that carry them in their mouths, but a lot of species that do parental care, especially with the fathers providing care, once the children get too big, if they keep hanging around and don't swim off, you know, then the dad might eat some of them, basically like a way of kicking them out of the nest. Like, you're old enough now, get off.
Fly free, baby bird, fly free.
Fly free. All
right. Oh, wild. Okay. So let's get going on the cannibalism. And just to be clear, the videos we were showing, so that's not all cannibalism, like the pike eating and the muskie eating each other. But it is kind of wild that like, fish that are gigantic will go after each other. Okay. Seasonal question. We are switching to, so I saw a story, admittedly, you know, we're all in the Great Lakes region. We're in the Midwest. We are not in Florida unless spring breaks are coming up. So maybe people are going there for that. I saw a story. It was somebody who was on the dock talking, and they were down in Florida, and they were talking about how the cooler winter was really pumping fish up. And it made me think like, okay, what the heck does that even mean? And I think what they were talking about was that the temperatures, when they had kind of cooler temperatures, when you bumped back up to warmer temperatures, it like got the fish excited somehow. So can you guys explain, like, does anything like that happen in the Great Lakes? Are there things where like you kind of have a colder winter makes the fish really, really excited later on in life or something like that? Maybe I'll throw that one to Titus first.
Yeah, you know, I can see that. You know, I watch the video too, and it's, you know, it's kind of a, from a, like an angling perspective, I think they're excited to eat. And, you know, maybe that's what we're seeing here. You know, they, especially in a place like Florida where it's generally warmer, you've had kind of a few weeks of colder, maybe less activity, maybe you're not feeding as much. And so when it warms up, you're like, hey, my metabolism says I need to eat, and I haven't been eating a lot. So, you know, going out and, you know, really starting to feed. And I think we could have a similar thing here in the Great Lakes. And, you know, really, right, you know, especially this winter, like we are getting into the fish are pumped up for spring spawning. And, you know, that's on its way too. And, you know, lots of, if you're say, a spring run sucker or a northern pike, that's queuing on temperature, like you're going to queue on it, even if it's, you know, say in February or early March. And we're actually with our sucker spawning monitoring, we are going to set up basically 3 weeks earlier than usual, just because this is such a winter, like a mild winter. So, you know, you don't want to miss it, because it's going to, when it happens, it happens.
Yeah. And that's a really good point, Titus. You know, we just have had a very strange winter here, and, you know, fish are exothermic or cold blooded. So they're, you know, all of their body functions, their metabolism depends on the temperature of the water. So any change in temperature, you know, is going to affect them probably more than us as, you know, warm blooded mammals who can regulate our body temperature. And, you know, speaking of the Great Lakes, we've seen really low ice cover, like historically low this year. I think the NOAA Great Lakes Environmental Lab that focuses on basically everything happening in the Great Lakes recently, yeah, just this past week came out with some numbers about how historically low that ice coverage is. And I think Lake Ontario and Lake Erie are basically near or tied with some of their lowest historic ice coverage on record, which is just wild to me. So that, yeah, Titus is totally right. That's going to have a big impact on when everybody starts spawning, when things start picking up again, for sure.
Yeah, it's definitely something we've seen up here in northeastern Wisconsin. You know, big kind of Green Bay has really developed into really, well, it's developed recently in the last decade, really targeting Lake Whitefish. But, you know, ice fishing is definitely, it's a part of the culture of the Great Lakes states and the northern, you know, northern hemisphere. Like, people get out on frozen water. It's, you know, I like to think of it as the great equalizer. Like, you can go to those places that you don't need a boat, you know, to get out there. Like, you can walk pretty much anywhere. And this winter, the ice hasn't been great. And, you know, like Green Bay barely had ice cover. It didn't really have any good ice at all. And, you know, now we're kind of into, yeah, here's a, you know, a story about ice fishing being canceled, and, you know, lots of different tournaments, different activities. You know, the Birkebeiner, the biggest 50th Birkebeiner this winter, is going to be this little 5-kilometer loop instead of the, you know, they're still going to have it, but it's not the real regular one. So
that's a good point. Like, the story that was just up on the screen was about Houghton Lake in Michigan, which originally had scheduled their ice fishing tournament for January. And then we're like, well, like, maybe let's push it off till February, because oftentimes, like, our ice maximums in the Great Lakes happen, you know, kind of mid late February. But it was rescheduled for this past weekend, and that article was just saying it got canceled again, and they obviously didn't reschedule it this time around. And we've seen something similar, you know, the sturgeon season in Black Lake was canceled, which is, you know, typically a very, like, important cultural event. So it's just, we're seeing kind of the effects of this, definitely in the angling around the Great Lakes this winter.
Yeah. And I, you know, on a sturgeon note too, here in Northeast Wisconsin, I mean, we have the biggest lake sturgeon population in the Lake Winnebago system. The kind of 2-week sturgeon spearing season for us is it's a huge, like, cultural, you know, piece of the culture. It's a huge tourism draw, and the ice on Lake Winnebago, and Lake Winnebago, it's a large lake, but it's also really shallow. So, you know, it has the potential to produce some ice. And it has been, you know, like they can't cancel the season because of the, you know, just the regulations, but hardly any, you know, very few people out there. I think opening weekend, it was like 100 shacks out on the ice compared to 2,000 to 3,000 shacks in a typical year. So, you know, very different. You know, where I get these daily emails about, you know, here's, cause it's one of the reasons we have this great sturgeon spearing is cause they manage it so well. And so you get like every day you can get these emails that are like, you know, this number of males were harvested, this number of females, you know, this number of immature females too. So, and the numbers are really small. It's, you know, 20, 25, I think 24 fish were harvested yesterday, which is not a lot of sturgeon from the, you know, 2,500 to 3,000 that you can harvest in total.
Wow.
That's crazy. So, and just to be clear, the pictures we were showing there were of past years, like 2012, 2014, and this year, you know, and there's like some language in some of those stories, like in good conscience, we can't send people out when it's not safe and things like that. So, I will note there were a couple of comments on the cannibalism front. So we'll back up to there.
Yes, back to cannibalism.
So back to happy things all around this Monday morning. Okay, so there was Aman Kohli said, Amanpreet Kohli said, sharing an observation from our lab, have seen this in rainbow trout as well. We would bring eggs to hatch in our lab and some from each batch would grow to be big and cannibalistic. I feel like that's...
You know, another example with that, like from aquaculture, like I know people are trying to raise things like walleye in hatchery environments. And that's definitely, you know, walleye are fish that eat other fish and they really need to be very, very active in grading them by size. Cause if you get, you know, a small walleye in a tank with a larger walleye, they're going to eat their, you know, basically brothers and sisters and cousins pretty quickly. So that, you know, one of the challenges here with trying to grow, you know, essentially walleye, rainbow trout, you know, these are our predators and we're trying to grow them in these controlled environments. You know, sometimes they're like, hey, I think, you know, that fish feed you're throwing in is great, but I'd really rather be eating, you know, some of these wiggly fish that are swimming around. So definitely
eating Cousin Harry. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
The Cousin Harry. You go like that. Oh, that's really funny. Okay. I mean, sorry. It shouldn't be funny, but it is.
It makes the family reunion a little bit awkward is all we're saying. So yeah.
A little bit. And so Stuart again had said, the dang fish in my aquarium keep reproducing. We'll need some to turn to cannibalism soon or it's going to be an issue. However, I did want to ask, like, based on what you were just saying, Titus, you know, that people need to be active in sorting things by size. So basically, if you want to grow a fish like that in aquaculture, you kind of have to go out and like every day, every couple of days and be re-tanking them is, I don't know, that's probably not a verb, but like moving them to other tanks. Is that how it goes?
Yeah. Basically, you know, one strategy is you can give them kind of a space to hide in that, you know, kind of like if you imagine like a, you know, like a cage basically where they could swim in, but their larger siblings and cousins can't, you know, that kind of gives them a place to escape from predation. But really a lot of it is you are kind of sorting them as they grow. And, you know, really if you're growing them for say an aquaculture food market, you know, you want to select out, you know, certain genetics there too. Like, you know, fish food is money and, you know, you want to, you know, kind of select the ones that are going to grow faster and, you know, really like any agriculture, you know, that's fish farming is farming. And, so it can be very active, you know, and it does depend on, you know, that kind of growth rate of different individuals, different, you know, genetic kind of combinations.
Cool.
I just had this horrifying vision as Titus was talking about farming and I'm like, oh my God, these cows eating other cows. But you know, not everything in the aquatic realm translates perfectly to
Don't kid yourself, Timmy. Okay. So, all right. So we'll do a reset really quickly here, and I won't go down the Simpsons rabbit hole. This is Ask Dr. Fish, a show where our two Dr. Fishes answer your fish questions, science questions, and life questions. If you have a question for our doctors, put it into the chat right now, and we will be able to answer it during this episode. If you have a question that you'd like to be answered in a future episode, you could email us at askdrfish@gmail.com. Okay, so we had an email from Niall Clancy, a member of the Montana chapter of the American Fisheries Society, or as those in the know call it, which I'm not always in the know with acronyms, AFS. So they have a new book about becoming a fishery biologist that they were sharing with us. So let's go maybe to Titus first. So like, how can one become a Dr. Fish?
Yeah, that is a great question. It's also a really, you know, I get to talk to a lot of kind of young professionals and graduate students. You know, one of the great things about going to like a Montana chapter of AFS, or we just had our Wisconsin chapter meeting of AFS last month, and there's always kind of a really good set up for connecting professionals with, you know, like grad students and undergrads. And, you know, I think one of the things that I always like to say is that, you know, we have kind of our individual experiences, and, you know, I think we all have our own path. Like the way I got to here right now, you know, talking to everybody about fish is different than the way that Katie got here. You know, we all have our kind of own paths, but to me, I think one of the really big things to really follow is, you know, experiences and trying different things and really being able to demonstrate that, hey, you know, I have handled fish and I've spent time in boats and those kinds of things can be really helpful. And, you know, generally within, say, if you're an undergrad, you know, there are usually opportunities to do that within school as a volunteer or, you know, in the summer. It's you know, what a great summer job is riding along with some biologists. And I love working with undergrad students in the summer too, you know, giving them lots of these experiences to, you know, set some nets in the Great Lakes and maybe fill some waders in a wetland, which is an essential experience. Getting stuck in mud, actually getting our boat stuck in Green Bay and everybody had to get out of the boat. We had to push it. It didn't work that well. You know, that's what happens when I'm in charge. We get stuck.
How about you, Katie? I feel like a lot of us have stories about boats failing or us failing. But anyway, Katie, how about you?
I was going to say, you know, we could have a whole episode of Ask Dr. Fish on fieldwork fails and tell you about the time, you know, the thunderstorm was coming and our motor died. So that will be another episode. But yes, I 100% agree with everything Titus said in terms of, you know, getting diverse experiences, you know, maybe field work is what you really like to do, but maybe you more like working in a lab or doing something more kind of computer-based, like modeling and figuring that out. So I think research, especially like if you're in the undergrad stage, is just so valuable to figure out what you like doing and what you don't like doing in terms of research. I'll also add that, you know, everyone's path to becoming a Dr. Fish is different, but the science part of our job is only one aspect of it. And there are a lot of skills that aren't necessarily always taught in grad school that are really valuable to being a Dr. Fish. Things like, you know, communicating your science, working with non-scientists, kind of leadership skills, like Titus said, you know, leading the research crew out in the field. And so I really think that, you know, yes, obviously you need to be involved in research and building those skills, but you also don't want to forget some of your other kind of more people skills, because the working with the fish is easy, working with the people is difficult.
Yeah, it's definitely true. And yeah, I mean, I was just talking to, I did three presentations last week, so talking to all kinds of different people, and it's like, hey, you know, so I would love to have it just be the science, like, you know, this, we're going to show you the science because it's going to convince you. But really that is, that is, you know, one step, but it's also, you know, it's relationships, it's communication. I'm going to plug this book, which is called Lessons in Leadership. I'm going to plug it because I got to write a chapter in here, which is, you know, it's basically 3 pages long, but I called my little chapter Leadership for Generalists, because I, of course, am a fisheries specialist who has never had any formal education in like fisheries biology. But hey, you pick it up over the decades. And now that I'm 20 plus years into my scientific career, I guess I can claim to be a fish biologist at this point. But, you know, just kind of what I got to write about, you know, it is taking the skills that you've brought. Like, I grew up on a farm and I was a beekeeper, and you know, not necessarily water related, but you know, the types of like running a crew and, you know, organizing things and getting the work done is definitely, you know, those types of things are very useful if you're, you know, running a field crew. So and also fails, lots of fails there that you know, learning lessons along the way.
Yeah, and that's a great point too, Titus, about, you know, highlighting your other experiences, even if they're not necessarily at, you know, fisheries based or even science based, but highlight, you know, if you're interviewing for a position or trying to get a research spot, you know, saying I have these skills, you know, that I've developed in these other experiences I've had, and I can bring these to the table, I think is something that sometimes we think about, okay, well, I haven't had any, you know, research experience, but you do still have kind of those other things. Like, I have attention to detail, and so that will help me, you know, be conscious in the lab and you know, be able to mark all of my tubes correctly and keep track of everything in a spreadsheet. So I think you can definitely capitalize on experiences you've had, but always, you know, keep trying to get new experiences so you figure out kind of what you like doing. Like, for me, I realized early on in undergrad, I didn't want to be in a lab 24/7. I wanted to be out on a boat. So that was helpful when it came time to like figure out what I wanted to do for grad school.
Wearing your flippy floppies.
Wearing my flippy floppies on my boat.
I mean, it's amazing. Like, you can actually, you can have a job where you get to be outside all the time. It's great. And, it is. You know, and you can also get stuck where, you know, if you move up the ladder in a fisheries career, you know, I know a lot of kind of senior fish biologists who, you know, they're in the office all the time. So, you know, even that, it's like, you know, you can, and maybe, you know, over time that becomes a thing you also want to do. You're like, I don't want to spend my whole summer out in a boat. I want to, you know, send other people out. So.
Cool. So thank you. And I just want to make a plug for learn how to write, read lots of different things and be, I feel like there's nowhere that writing won't help you. So even though I'm not a Dr. Fish. So, okay. Thanks so much. And apologies if anyone's joining us on Facebook. Sorry that the first feed didn't work. We had like some kind of mess up, and the easiest thing for me to do was just start another feed. So if you were planning to come, we'll try to post the link for this afterward. We apologize. We're doing better every time, but we still make mistakes. Okay. We have a typical spot during our episodes that is who's spawning now, because there's always someone who's spawning. So we're going to throw it over to Dr. Titus and ask, Titus, who's spawning now in the Great Lakes?
Yeah, so not a lot of spawning going on. We do have fall spawning. So we do have eggs that incubate over the winter. But this is the time of year, February, mid-February, Burbotine Day. It is, of course, when the burbot spawn, one of the few fish that is spawning under the ice, as it were. Maybe not this year because there isn't as much ice on the lake, but they are, you know, they are one of the few fish that will spawn right in the middle of winter. You know, and I love burbot. They're one of my favorites. You know, look at our logo. That's a burbot in there with me. That was my one fish for this show that I got to pick. And, you know, burbot are really cool. They actually make noises. They've discovered that through the science.
I can play the noises here. Let me give it a try.
Let's try it.
All right.
Yeah, it's a bourbon beat.
Oh my goodness.
Some excited burbot there. So, you know, probably males. I think the idea is they're actually kind of like drumming on their swim bladders with the muscles that run along those. So burbot, really cool fish species, freshwater member of the cod family, the only freshwater species for the cod family, and also delicious. Eat those if you get a chance. So keep an eye out for it. They're tasty.
They also have some great names, other common names like lawyer, eel pout. I think, and then is it poor man's lobster?
Yes, or, yes. Okay. I like to think of lobster as poor man's burbot. That is my, you know, lobster. Yeah, anybody can get a lobster, but can you get a burbot? No.
Yeah, and we don't care about those invertebrates, you know.
No, no.
Y'all are killing me. Okay.
So, of course, we will be talking about food later. And if you know, it's so simple. You take some burbot, it has this loin along the back, kind of along the spine. You get these really just kind of nice medallion of meat. Mm-hmm. And I've deep fried those, but I've also, you can just boil them and then dip them in butter and they're delicious. You know, that's kind of the poor man's lobster kind of way to prepare it, because it, you know, you dip anything in butter, it's delicious.
Everything's better with butter.
Absolutely.
So I'm actually gonna flip to that right now. I'm gonna double check that there are no comments or questions. Okay, I'm gonna flip to our fish challenge, because we're talking about eating, we're talking about enjoying things. So if you've followed our show, maybe two episodes ago, Stuart introduced this segment, like the Ask Dr. Fish Challenge. So I think in December, we were supposed to celebrate Fishmas. And then during December, we had a conversation about the Feast of the Seven Fishes and things like that. And so the challenge that I issued was a try a new to you fish dish. And so right now, I'm going to give my update about what I did. And then if anyone in our audience actually participated in the challenge, please share your experiences in the chat. I guess I will say for me, it was actually on Christmas Eve. We had some leftover halibut that someone had given us, like brought us back from Alaska, that I found in the freezer. And so we made orange halibut. It was really nice. We learned a new like way of cooking the fish. It was kind of like poaching it a little bit. My kids loved it. They're like 8 and 10. And so they're actually trying different foods now. It's very exciting. So it was really, really nice. And it was nice to have like a, you know, kind of special Christmassy dish with the oranges and the herbs and things like that. And it was really tasty. So Titus, what did you try? Or did you have a chance to try anything? And if so, what did you try?
I did. So I actually, this was, my mom was visiting and she doesn't get a lot of seafood. So, and we've got a lot in our freezer. So I was like, I'm going to try this. So I pulled down the recipe books. And this is from the America's Test Kitchen. It's called Sicilian Fish Stew. Their recipe used swordfish, which I didn't have, but I had two different kinds of Alaskan salmon here. So that's Kita and sockeye. I also threw in some Pacific cod. And then up on top are some Georgia wild caught shrimp. So just a nice kind of tomato based. We keep seeing Katie's recipe too, but you know, fairly simple. I think you know, I in my house, like, people aren't necessarily into fish most of the time or some of the time. But if you can get enough flavors in there, you know, there's a lot going on, and it's, you know, kind of a tomato based thing is really good. And then I had leftovers and I actually boiled up some pasta. And it, you know, it turned really well into a pasta sauce later on. So it's a pretty dynamic dish, and, you know, it was tasty. So give it a try.
That's really awesome. Just this past week, I'll go back to invertebrates. We made shrimp Creole because it was Mardi Gras, and we did the same thing with the leftover sauce. We were putting it over rice, and it was pretty awesome. So Katie, did you try something? And if so, what did you try?
I did. And so I will say mine was kind of a cop out. You know, I really had a busy January. And one would think, you know, maybe hors d'oeuvres, that's more of like a holiday thing. I was just like, well, I'm really busy, but I want to try something new. And so I'd come across this recipe for smoked salmon pinwheels, which are a typical, like, you know, party snack where it's basically pieces of smoked salmon with a sort of cream cheese filling, and you wrap it up in a little pinwheel shape. So I tried this one recipe that was really, really straightforward. So I bought some smoked salmon from the store. I bought kind of like a cream cheese that I mixed in some herbs with, rolled them up, and then just had these little pinwheels as nice little protein-based snacks that I could pop in my mouth every now and then. It probably is more, like I said, appropriate for a holiday party, but it could just be, you know, me in my apartment, you know, noshing on some smoked salmon and cream cheese, which was good. So,
Katie, there is nothing wrong with that. I was looking at that. It's like smoked salmon and cream cheese. You know,
I mean, you can't go wrong.
It's a wonderful combination. You know, who even needs a bagel? Like, just you're using, you know, instead of the bagel, you're just rolling it up in
just the having salmon. Just a little salmon snack. So,
yeah. And I'll throw in just some upcoming Eat Wisconsin fish related stuff that Sharon Moan and I are going to be doing. My colleague, who is our Wisconsin food fish coordinator at Wisconsin Sea Grant. So we are in a couple weeks, we are going to be heading down to the Milwaukee Sports Show in Milwaukee. And it's a big kind of regional at our state fairgrounds. And we're going to do a couple different demos of cooking. Basically, something I have been dreaming about for several years is creating the new summer food of the Great Lakes, and it should be a Lake Whitefish roll. So, you know, you've had lobster rolls out east, actually, and you can get them everywhere now. But we're going to prepare Sharon's going to make a cold lobster or whitefish roll. I'm going to make a hot whitefish roll, kind of with a butter all over it. So that's going to be delicious. And then later on in March, we're going to be heading up to the Wisconsin Aquaculture Association meeting, which is going to be hosted in Red Cliff, Wisconsin. Minnesota Aquaculture Association is going to be there too. And we're going to do a little kind of Wisconsin fish demo on the Friday night. So that'll be fun, you know, preparing some. So we've got a month of Great Lakes fish. We've got a month of farm-raised Wisconsin fish as well. So you can tell I mostly just think about what food can I eat and how can I do that at work?
That's so, I mean, you saying like whitefish roll kind of thing, I was like, oh yeah, that sounds
good. Oh yeah.
So it's great. So another thing that's coming up in the next little bit, you know, and you talking about Wisconsin makes me think about this too. So first off, I'll share that Stuart's new to him was he was going to try some smelt, which is so Wisconsin. It's kind of like, I don't know,
a cliche. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So we'll try to, maybe we'll try to add a link to his video in the show notes for this, for when we release the recording of this down the line. But it is fish fry season. This is an awesome t-shirt that Titus shared. It says Friday night fish fry in Wisconsin, choice of potato, coleslaw, and rye bread. Over in Michigan, there are lots of really awesome fish fries too. So I believe that our next Dr. Fish challenge, am I right that it's try a fish fry?
Yes. So our next Dr. Fish challenge is going to be kind of a little open-ended. We are going to say try a fish fry, but, you know, maybe we'll have some subcategories like, you know, best fish fry, how many fish fries you've been to, you know, between now and the next Ask Dr. Fish episode. So it's a little open-ended, but basically getting out there and trying some fish fries in your area.
Yeah. Try that local fish and you know, see what the options are. And, you know, it doesn't have to be a Friday. Hey, you get a fish fry on Tuesday. Yeah. Why don't you have fish tacos? I mean, hey, those are delicious. Tacos.
They are delicious. It's and true. doesn't have to be fried fish. You know, maybe it's a baked fish.
Yeah. Awesome. Okay, so that's our Ask Dr. Fish challenge for next time. And again, you know, we encourage you to share with us if you participate in this. We like sharing stories and people's comments.
Or share your favorite fish fry and, you know, in your area.
Yeah.
Go and get your fish.
Yeah. There you go. There you go. Cool.
Yeah, we love the insider insider knowledge.
We need the scoop on where to go.
Okay. So once again, this is Ask Dr. Fish, a show where our two Dr. Fishes answer your fish questions, science questions, and life questions. If you have a question that we'll try to answer before the end of today, please go ahead and put it into the chat. Or if you have comments, we like to share those too. If you would like to have a question answered in the future, please go ahead and email it to askdrfish@gmail.com. So one final question, something that comes up a lot, in the Great Lakes in particular, but it happens all over the world, is fish stocking. And so for those who maybe haven't grown up thinking about this or haven't been in a position, things like that. So Katie, maybe I'll throw it to you first. What is fish stocking and why do it?
Yeah, so fish stocking is really just, you know, the idea that you raise fish kind of artificially, you know, whether that's in a place like a hatchery or a pond, and then you take those fish that you've raised and put them into a water body, whether, you know, that's to increase the fishing opportunities for anglers or to reintroduce a species maybe that has been, you know, the numbers have been down because of any number of factors, something that's threatened or endangered. And the idea behind that is, you know, kind of supplementing fish in an area. It can be, you know, either native fish that are raised and stocked in systems, but sometimes it's non-native fish, which one example in the Great Lakes are some of the Pacific salmon like Chinook and Coho. And in some cases, you know, some of these fish do have some natural reproduction, but to maintain the levels that, you know, kind of anglers expect, it's supplemented with stocking from various, you know, state agencies like Department of Natural Resources.
Yeah, it's like I was talking earlier about, you know, in our cannibalism section, you know, thinking about within an aquaculture system, because basically fish hatcheries and stocking fish, it's aquaculture.
It is.
You know, just the same as any other kind of fish farm. It's just, you know, growing these fish to release. And what you know, the farming environment gives these fish is just the ideal conditions. You know, generally lots of mortality for fish is in this kind of first, you know, from the eggs. There's a lot of mortality where the eggs don't hatch, or they get infected with fungus, or they're eaten by crayfish or round gobies, or you know, apparently their parent fantail darters potentially. So you know, we have this you know, the controlled environment really can, you know, aid success. And so there's lots of different considerations when you talk fish stocking. Like you can, and it's also a balance thing. So the longer a fish would stay in a hatchery, the more it's going to cost to maintain. But generally, the larger size when it's released, the higher the survival. So you know, you get a lot of, you know, it's all very species specific. So say for a species like walleye, you can, you know, get those and you can release them as fry. So they're very small, like an inch long. So you've kind of gotten them past the egg and the larval stage. You release them as fry and you can release a lot of them that way, because that's fairly easy and it's a short time in the hatchery. Or you can raise them to fingerling size, so they're kind of the size of your finger, or even longer than that. So, you know, generally it's all these trade-offs in, you know, deciding which species, how much space you have, you know, how much it's going to cost. And then, you know, what cost is it going to be? Like how many of those walleye that get stocked are actually going to be caught by someone down the road too? So you can actually kind of, you know, and we have lots of great science now where you can, you know, tag these fish and actually see, you know, for Katie's example, Pacific salmon, like we can look at these little very tiny coated wire tags. So these tags that have a little number on them implanted in these, you know, very small salmon before they're released. And then you can go to a fish cleaning station, collect that head, and pull that number out from that little tag and actually see, oh, you know, 3 years ago, this individual fish was released from, you know, this port. And then, you know, you look at that at all around the lakes and can actually make decisions about, hey, what's the best place to stock a fish? What's the, you know, maybe we shouldn't stock the fish here because they're not surviving. And, you know, that's just kind of good management.
Yeah. And I'm really glad Titus brought up balance too, because that's a big thing in the Great Lakes, not only in terms of balance of when to release the raised fish, but also like how many fish to release based, because you want to make sure you're not releasing too many predators and not having enough prey to feed them, which is something that I know, you know, there's been a lot of work and a lot of research done to understand, you know, we've had the lakes change a lot because of things like invasive species. And so that's changed how many prey fish are available. And so a lot of times it's balancing how many of these predators are we going to have so that we can keep a predator prey balance that doesn't throw the whole system out of whack.
And you shared this really cool resource that I shared the link in there. Can you tell us what we're looking at, Katie?
Yeah, so this is a really cool interactive database that you can look and see where, basically what species were released in what different parts of the Great Lakes. And you can look by year, you can look by agency, species, and you can kind of see like, okay, you know, last year there were this many lake trout released in Lake Michigan, or, you know, wherever your location of interest is. So I find it just a really cool way to look at what's going on around the Great Lakes. I particularly was very interested in looking at like where lake sturgeon were released, because I just think lake sturgeon are the coolest and I like seeing them, you know, I like seeing efforts towards restoring them, but you can look at whatever your species of interest is.
Yeah. And I'd say this really captures, you know, and this is a great resource to have, like, you know, looking at, you know, the science and the management of the Great Lakes. Like this is, it really shows the collaborative nature of how these decisions are made. Like, you know, we have two countries involved, we have multiple states, we have multiple tribal nations as well. And everyone is, you know, kind of working together, I think, to really, do those balanced decisions, because, you know, the fish we stock in Wisconsin are going to swim, you know, they're going to go everywhere. They're going to, you know, swim across state lines. They don't really care. They don't know those maps are there. So, you know, you really do need the kind of cooperative consensus-based decision-making and, you know, keeping it balanced and keeping it, you know, we want sustainable fisheries. So, you know, lots of work going on.
I geek out over stuff like this all the time. So another way, so Titus, you mentioned the tags that are kind of stable, but there's also GLaTOS, the Great Lakes Acoustic Telemetry Observing System, I think, or something like that. I'm very bad with acronyms, as we mentioned before, but they have stations all over. So this is a map of some of them. And it's a super cool way, because like you said, the fish don't respect boundaries. Yeah. The like legal boundaries that humans have imposed. So it's a really, really cool resource to track things.
We've got a bunch of suckers that have acoustic tags swimming around Green Bay right now. So that is something that hopefully we'll get to talk to Karen Murchie someday at the Shedd Aquarium and get an update on, you know, what are those fish doing and where are they going? And, you know, GLaDOS is such a great resource right now, because there's so much, and it's about cooperation. Like I can buy a few tags and maybe get a receiver, but it's all this working together. And there's so many receivers out there now. Like you saw those green dots. If you're looking at the map, you're listening to this, imagine the Great Lakes covered in all these green dots, like green chicken pox. And, but those are all, you know, basically receivers listening for the pings coming out of these tagged fish. And, you know, there's all kinds of species tagged and they're swimming around and everybody's collecting data and sharing it. So it's exciting times in the Great Lakes.
Genuinely. It really, really is. So, okay. So, once again, thank you to everyone who's joining us. Toward the end of each show, we do a game. We have not played 20 questions in a while. So I think that's what we're going to do today. Katie, you pick. Would you like to be the asker or the person who picks the fish?
I'll pick the fish this time.
All right, so Katie's going to pick a fish, and then Titus has 20 questions. And I'm not going to do what Stuart normally does, where he has us go around, because I am just a liability for you, Titus. So I will just count how many questions we have left. So Katie, let us know when you're ready to go. And those in the online, feel free to put your guesses in, and I'll try to share those questions. Katie can see your suggestions as well, and Titus can see your suggestions. Okay, Katie, okay. Good to go?
I'm good to go.
Titus.
Okay. Okay. Question one. Adults are large or small?
Large.
Okay. Large adults. Let's see. Number of two dorsal fins or one?
Let me double check. One.
One dorsal fin. Okay. Any dorsal spines?
I don't believe so, no.
Okay. Let's see. Adipose fin present or absent?
No.
No adipose fin. Let's see. Mouth type. Let's say, is it a terminal mouth right off the end of the face?
I would say it's terminal, maybe a little subterminal.
Okay. Terminal, subterminal. Does it eat fish?
No.
Not a fish eater. Okay. Does it see, this is a lot of pressure to ask.
I know, it just wants all the questions.
I know. And I have to like keep track of them too, which is okay. I'm just I enjoy the numbers too that I get to watch.
I know, you get to watch it countdown. Yeah.
No pressure. No
yeah. Pressure. Let's see. Does it have, is the dorsal fin or, okay, caudal fin. So is the tail square?
No, it is not square.
Is the tail forked?
Yeah, not like a sharp, deep fork though.
Okay. But generally forked.
Yeah.
Is it a nest guarder? Does it guard nests?
No.
Okay.
Does it live in the benthos?
I would say you generally will see it closer to the benthos.
That was a question from the audience. So we're at 10 now.
Excellent. Is it in the sucker family?
No.
Okay. Not a sucker. This is terrible. You guys are killing me with this. I need Stuart's bad questions to really help me reset.
Where's Stuart when you need him?
I know.
What? One hint. Ask about its native status.
Oh, is it native to the Great Lakes?
Nope.
Okay.
That was very kind of you, Kate.
Yes. It's a good question. Definitely something to be aware of. Does it eat plants?
Yes.
Is it a grass carp?
It is a grass carp.
Boom. Yay!
We didn't do the drum roll that Stuart always does, but
okay. So Titus, your 60-second soapbox, because the winner of the game gets 60 seconds to talk about whatever they want to talk about. Titus, go.
All right. Hey, everybody. So 60 seconds to talk about something. And, you know, I am going to just reinforce our contest for this coming 2 months. And it is go try some new fish fries. And I want you to go out. I want you to try new fish. I want you to try fish fries different ways. I know that, you know, I used to own that Wisconsin fish fry shirt until it totally wore out because I wore it so much because, you know, it's sort of in line with what my job is. So it doesn't have to be just deep fried fish. There's lots of ways you can eat fish. Why don't you whip up some fish on your own on Friday too? So, you know, try some new things, go to some new places, enjoy fish, meet your neighbors. Have fun with it. So, you know, definitely a time of year that a lot of people are eating fish. And hey, why? It doesn't need to be just this time of year. You can eat fish all the time. So do it.
Fish Lovely. Friday, every Friday.
Make fish every Friday. Friday fish Friday. I mean, I'm from Wisconsin, so that's basically... that's sort of our culture here anyway. So,
okay. Awesome. And in lieu of Stuart being here, thank you all for joining us. And this will be slightly less professional than it normally is, but you know, we'll just do our best. All right.
Ask Dr. Fish is brought to you by the fine people at Illinois Indiana Sea Grant, Wisconsin Sea Grant, and Booby Dog Media. The show is produced and hosted by Stuart Carlton, Carolyn Foley, Dr. Fish Katie O'Reilly, and Dr. Fish Titus Bellmare.
The live broadcast is supported by Moti Agumbiande, and the podcast version of the show is edited by It's still me. The podcast artwork is by Ethan Kosak, and you can view his portfolio at ethankosak.com. That is K-O-C-A-K.
If you have questions for the Dr. Fish, send an email to askdrfish@gmail.com. Use the Twitter hashtag, yeah, we're still calling it Twitter, Ask Dr. Fish, or call our hotline at 765-496-4474. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you live on Facebook and YouTube at 11 a.m. Eastern on usually the second Monday of every even month. In between now and then, if you have fish questions, science questions, or life questions, just ask Dr. Fish.
How long are you going to make me do this?
There we go. Thanks so much, everybody, for joining us. And please watch out for a future episode and send us some questions if you have them. Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.